You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the News Director at GNAT TV's News Project. Pleasure to have you with us today on Wednesday, April 26th. Also, a great pleasure to be joined here in the studio by Ed Surgeon, who is the Executive Director at the Manchester Community Library. He's served in that post since last August. And Ed, great to have you down here to hear about what's going on at the library and talk a little bit about some of the other issues that are facing libraries around the country, for that matter. Again, thank you for making the time for this. Really good to have you here. And, welcome to GNAT.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to join you today.
But I just thought, Ed, to kind of get us started here, you've been now in the job at the library for, what, about 8 months or so? I guess, how's it been going? What struck you the most about the new job?
Well, the appeal, why I was so intrigued about taking the position was the opportunity to serve a much larger community. And librarians very rarely get to change lanes. And so if you are an academic librarian, you stay there in your college. If you're a law librarian, you might stay with your law firm. If you are a school librarian, you stay in schools. If you are a public librarian, you're a public librarian. So I come out of the school world, and to have the opportunity to work with a much, much bigger population and to serve that is the excitement and the real challenge. And of course, as Manchester Community Library, there's about 4,500 residents in Manchester, but in fact, our service reach is almost all of Bennington County. So north to Rutland, south to Bennington, east to the ski towns. And so our real service population is maybe 20,000, 25,000 people. And so having everyone from the region, as well, of course, from Manchester, makes it a lot of fun. But the real challenge, of course, is being new to Vermont and being new to the library. The job on day one, the job today, the job really continuous that goes on as long as I'm lucky enough to do it, is getting to know everybody and know the community. And one of the great things about Vermont, and I think really distinctive, and I'm sure folks who've lived here for a long time appreciate it, is the very, very intimate relationship-based nature of our communities. And so really, if you're going to be successful here and do good work, it's going to be based upon building strong relationships. So that's been a huge chunk of what I've been trying to do. I'm fortunate to have a really good staff and have been able to hire several highly qualified people to round out our team. You know, things are going really well. And knock on wood, our number of visits is up about 60% year over year. Our programs are at their highest level ever. We're going to run about 600 programs this year. We are having very, very high improved levels of circulation of our books and audiobooks. And, you know, I think there's just a general sense that we are working very hard to become really, really deeply engaged in the community. So we're doing a ton of work with our area organizations, whether they're nonprofits, groups, clubs, et cetera, and trying to not only be a good host with our facilities, but to bring the various organizations to work together and collaborate. I think one of the things that struck me in these first few months is that the scale of many of the opportunities, needs, and honestly problems that we have require that kind of collaboration and partnership. And so getting up to scale to be able to tackle some of these things is really important. So we're trying to do that too.
Well, certainly a lot going on at the library, and coming out of the pandemic, I'm sure has been even another thing to wrestle with. But to your point, clearly one of the library's missions is to be something of a community center, to be a place where people go to either get classes or hear speakers or events of one sort or another.
Yep.
And I definitely want to get into that and explore that a little bit more with you before we wind up. But one of the things I wanted to kind of poke a little bit about was this whole sort of national phenomenon that seems to be happening, at least one hears a lot about it, about books that are being challenged or folks in certain communities asking for books to be pulled off shelves or sequestered away in some way. We pulled up a couple of the numbers from the American Library Association about challenges to books. And last year, in 2022, they documented 1,269 demands, this is across the entire country, to censor library books and resources, and that was a big jump from the year before, almost twice as many as in 2021, when there were 729. And total of 2,571 unique titles being targeted for censorship and being challenged. I guess I just wondered, why do you think this is going on? What is happening here? And should we be concerned about it?
Well, Andrew, what you're acknowledging, I have to painfully recognize too, is that libraries and librarians are now part of our culture wars. And I think the reasons for that are relatively straightforward to understand. Librarians are committed to intellectual freedom, free speech, freedom of expression, inclusion, and the right to read. Furthermore, almost all libraries, whether public or school libraries, are American Library Association members. We have a Library Bill of Rights, a Code of Ethics. We take these very seriously within the profession. And there's a quote that the ALA released recently that I'll read to you that I think summarizes where most libraries and librarians find themselves. Everyone is entitled to find books that reflect their interests, their experiences, their backgrounds, and their identities on the shelves of a publicly funded library that's there to serve everyone. This ties to something that inspires me that I find in the Vermont statutes. The Vermont statutes specify two roles for public libraries. The first is public library, traditionally as we know it. And the second is as community center, which we'll touch on in a while. But in the brief paragraph talking about the role of public library as public library, Vermont explicitly acknowledges that libraries are here as engines of democracy. This is where citizens are able, regardless of means, regardless of their socioeconomic background, their race, their sexual orientation, what have you, to be able to freely access information. And this is absolutely vital to maintaining an informed citizenry, which is the bedrock of democracy. And I think many, maybe not all, folks in this country would acknowledge there's been some challenges to our democratic institutions in recent years.
Mm-hmm. I think it was interesting to kind of do a bit of a geographic breakdown on where some of these challenges and issues are coming from. And I'm sure everyone might be curious about Vermont, which I'm sure a lot of people think, oh, we don't have any challenges. But there were three that were made across the state last year involving a total of five books. That's not very many, but what struck me was, and this is really fascinating, in next door neighbor Massachusetts, 45 challenges involving 57 books. That seems kind of surprising. Not a surprise, perhaps, the statewide leader in these challenges is Texas, 93 challenges involving 2,349 unique book titles. That's pretty amazing. But here's something else that's also interesting. In West Virginia, where you thought, oh, there might be a lot of people going, hey, I don't want that book on the shelves of my library where my kid might read it, Only 3 challenges, same as Vermont, same number. 8 books in that case as opposed to 5. In Nevada, no challenges at all.
You've pointed out there's been a big jump. I think the ALA stats show a 75% jump in book challenges in 2021 over 2020. Those challenges were roughly split between school and public libraries. So for anyone who's curious and wonders, are they coming, you know, more from one or another, it's a pretty even split. Interestingly though, prior to 2020, most of the challenges were individual challenges to individual book titles. And now the vast majority, about 90%, are multi-book challenges, and these are increasingly being made by political and religious affiliated groups. 40% of these challenges were of 100 books or more, mass challenges. And that is very, very different. Now, also, half of the most challenges books, the most challenged books, have LGBTQ themes. Also often themes involving race and social issues. And it is very, very interesting that that's where that concentration is. We're also seeing, and talking about these mass challenges, we're seeing a new phenomenon, and there was an example that was in the news today that's being referred to as shadow banning. Shadow banning is a administrative way of doing an almost global ban. An example would be Duval County in Florida. It's a school district, about 150,000 students. 1.6 million books were set aside, either to be covered or to be removed from student access while they're being reviewed. To date, only 25,000 of those titles have been approved. So effectively, this administrative process has removed almost the entirety of the district's book collection from teacher and student access. This is a relatively new development. All of this has led to a high level of uncertainty and honestly fear in the library community. And the scary part about that is that now we're starting to see what you could almost describe as self-censorship, where librarians, teachers, school media specialists are not bringing in titles just because they think a book might be challenged.
When a library does get a challenge or a request from one of the residents in the town to pull a book off the shelves, that must create a lot of tension and anxiety among the staff.
Well, I think that, again, it depends on the nature of the challenge. You know, I'm in my 13th year as a librarian. The libraries that I've been fortunate enough to serve in have had collection development policies, and they clearly outline how the library goes about acquiring materials and choosing them and their appropriateness for the community. These collection development policies are almost always, I can't imagine that they wouldn't be, reviewed by a board of trustees or the school administration or a school board. And then there's always accompanying this a challenge policy. So a parent, an individual library patron, what have you, can come in and say, hey, you know, I'd like you to take a look at this title, and then there's a formal process by which that book is examined, reviewed, and then the decision reported back to the individual or group in question. What is so different now is that the concentration of interest in banning the books that involve themes that are about folks who are queer, transgender, racially based story themes, et cetera. That is new. It used to be a much, much broader range of potential titles than this concentration we're seeing now.
I mean, are there any books you could think of, or certain subject areas that you think, well, yeah, that's not a book I want to have in my library? I mean, are there certain types of books like that that you could just say, hey, look at, I don't know, I'm just trying to think of an example, Glorification of Nazism, let's say. Would that be the sort of thing that you would say, you know what, that's beyond the pale?
Well, again, this goes back to the heart of a collection development policy, and it would be unusual that a library would want to bring in material that they know is factually inaccurate. That is not something that would be common. Now, fiction allows for a non-factual interpretation and view of the world. That is indeed what it is all about, and that's perfectly fine. But to bring in something that purportedly is accurately depicting something that's a historical or social trend or whatever in a completely unsubstantiated way, no, we probably would not want to include that. Mm-hmm. Clearly, things that would be explicitly pornographic, you wouldn't include in a library collection. But beyond that, you really want to be able, as a library, to represent the full spectrum of human thought, opinion, and knowledge. And so I've heard it said anecdotally, I'm not sure who we can attribute it to exactly, that a good library has something in it to offend everyone. And that's because the library should reflect a range of opinion that goes well beyond that of any of us as individuals. I'm reminded, and I'm going to paraphrase Francis Bacon here, he said something centuries ago that went along the lines of, read not to agree or disagree, but to weigh and consider. And so ultimately, one of the great value of books is to encourage all of us to think for ourselves. And one of the ways that we are best able to do that is to intentionally make ourselves engage with thoughts, ideas, perspectives that are not our own. And that's what a good library can do for us.
Libraries have also been in the news a lot in connection with the Vermont State University that is formally going to open this fall. But one proposal that came out earlier this year was, in order to help square up the finances correctly, that their libraries, in the traditional sense, would be closed down and sort of replaced with a digital version. And that was greeted with a lot of outcry that we can't do that. And I believe yesterday that plan was formally shelved. But I guess I just wondered, what did you make of that idea?
I've said this in a couple of other places, and I'm trying to be as tactful as I possibly can. That decision was idiotic. And the lesson in there, I think, for all of us to learn is that when one contemplates a wide-ranging decision like this, you have to be inclusive of all the various constituencies that are going to be impacted before you make the decision. And clearly, in this case, there were many, many the state that were not involved or considered at all. And I doubt that, and I hope that will not happen again, but thinking about this decision that has recently come down, I've actually had in the last 24 hours a couple of people congratulate me on our victory that we have gotten this rescinded. And first, I have to point out My own involvement has been tiny compared to others. Yes, I wrote a couple of letters and I, you know, spoke on the radio and all that, which, yeah, that's great. And that's part of my role in being a visible leader in our library community in the state. But I think the congratulations are a bit premature. And it's a reconsideration. It is not a final decision. And so I think that what VSU has done here is a strategic retreat. And so can we be cautiously optimistic that they are serious about a deliberative and collaborative approach going forward? Well, I most certainly hope that that's going to be true as they formulate next steps. And to that end, perhaps the lesson for everyone who has been part of speaking out and making their opposition to this clear, we're all going to have to remain vigilant and continue to push for transparency and accountability. Ultimately, we're almost certainly headed in a far, far better direction than where that original decision was leading us. So it's good news and hopefully better to come.
I think this sort of leads us towards what we talked about before we wind up in that whole thing about being a library, being a community center. But before we leave this, I can't help but wonder though if that this whole experience has been sort of a preview of what might be headed down the road, where, you know, in the future libraries will be largely digital. Why might that not be, you know, not a horrible scenario to think about? Maybe not in the next decade or two, but, you know, at some point down the road.
If we think about all of the published body of books that exist today, a small fraction, maybe 10%, have been digitized. And it is not an inconsiderable expense to go back and digitize works that are less recent. So many, many book titles have very specialized interests. So there is no economic incentive to digitize them. These are things that exist typically in places like research libraries at universities. And so a title might be on the shelf. It might have three readers in a quarter of a century. But those three readers that are doing research on a specific topic, they need to have access to that book. That book is probably going to be, under any scenario we can envision, very, very low on the prioritization list to be digitized. So just in terms of the scope of human knowledge that is currently digitized, you know, it is so easy to go onto Google, type in your search term. Now, ChatGTP will do a search based upon your natural language query. You can ask it a question. It'll give you back responses. But it is not looking at the entirety of the information. It's certainly not all the titles that have been published. And that just starts to touch the tip of the iceberg. We also know, studies have been done, there's a demonstrable difference in comprehension, retention, deep learning that occurs depending upon the type of media that you encounter a text. So it's great, for instance, to have your tablet, laptop, or phone for getting a quick update on the news or the weather forecast or checking sports scores or stock information. When you really want to do the deep dive, it's shown over and over that having that engagement with the book, the print on the page, is overwhelmingly better. So I think when we think about it from a standpoint of education and student learning, I can't imagine, for instance, that we would ever want to be teaching Shakespeare, who celebrated his birthday on Monday, by reading the text digitally. just doesn't seem to add up.
Okay, in a few minutes we have left, I did want to get to this point about the libraries becoming not just places where you take out a book, but becoming broader community centers.
Libraries are increasingly one of the rare true third spaces that we have in our communities. And you know, historically, this would have been the role of one's church, social organizations, clubs, fraternal organizations, et cetera, that have receded in importance. The library is a space, one of the few, again, that we have that anyone in the community can come to, is welcome, open access, and where you are not being asked to reach into your wallet for the privilege of being there. And you know, even think about going out in the morning for a cup of coffee. You walk in the coffee shop, there's an expectation that you're going to spend at least a little bit of money. You walk into a store, the expectation is that there's a commercial relationship. And that characterizes the overwhelming majority of spaces outside of our homes and school environments. So the library is one of these unique third spaces. Everyone in the community, when you are working to engage people of all ages, come, mix, interact, and ultimately, I look at our job now, you know, coming back to the traditional library model of the collection we're developing as books. Today, the collection we're developing is the community itself. What we're really in is the information business and the knowledge creation business. And I'm a big believer that knowledge is created by cultivating conversation. We could do a deep dive. We could do a separate program on conversation theory and Gordon Pask at some point, who also was a fellow he's recently passed away, had a lot of influence in early artificial intelligence work. By building these conversations, these intentional conversations between community members, this is how we strengthen our community, how we grow our community, and how we, frankly, improve our quality of life for each other. And you know, it is heartwarming to see multi-generations of community residents interacting with one another in ways that perhaps they never do outside of their family, but it happens in the library because of the types of programming and events that we put on. And it's also interesting in many places now, libraries are serving as a social services connective tissue as well. And I think Vermont is a state, and again, you know, I'm only here a short period of time, but compared to some other areas in the country, we don't have quite the same level of social services. And that's not a criticism. I think there are some very significant historical reasons for this. You think about the geography of the state, the low population density, the smaller towns, transportation infrastructure, et cetera, has all led to some of this. And now libraries, and we're trying to do this in Manchester, is to again, work with other organizations so that together, while we all work for the greater good, we're working to do the greatest good together. And this is this power of collaboration and partnership that we're really trying to focus on.
All right. Well, it's certainly an important and vital part of the community, and yeah, I go there all the time. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Ed. Unfortunately, much more I'm sure we could chat about, but time is just about up. So I want to thank you again for making the time to be here and tell us a little bit about what's going on at the library and whatnot. And to all of you who have been watching, thank you for being with us today and sharing part of your day with us. Hope you found the program interesting. We'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, take care. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.